Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, actresses Jamie Jones and Stacey Ross talk about their roles as teacher and parent in Gideon's Knot, now at the Aurora Theater in Berkeley. I visited earlier this week with pianist Hélène Grimaud, now performing Brahms' first piano concerto with the San Francisco Symphony. She's a truly fascinating person who has done wonderful work for wolf conservation outside of her musical world. She's also experiencing synesthesia, experiences different musical keys as different colors. You'll hear that conversation, replete with passing fire trucks and stage announcements from the green room at Davies Symphony Hall as part of this hour. Comedian Marga Gomez shares details about Lovebirds, her 10th one-woman show, now at the Marsh. I guess it's the talented women edition of Open Air, but also being the first Thursday of the month, critic Joshua Cosman will be in the house to share his classical picks for the month ahead. Stay tuned. Jonna Adams' play Gideon's Knot, now playing at the Aurora Theater in Berkeley, opens with a parent-teacher conference and a mother seeking answers as to why her fifth grader has been suspended. Was he a bully or a victim? To help us sort out the drama that unfolds, I'm pleased to welcome the entire cast of Gideon's Knot. Not hard to do, as it is a two-woman show. Jamie Jones, who has traveled from the far northern city of Sacramento, where she and her husband are co-directors of the B Street Theater Conservatory, and Bay Area actress, Aurora Theater regular Stacey Ross. Ladies, welcome to KLW.
Thank you so much.
Gideon's Knot is being billed as a visceral and provocative theater experience. Really? A parent-teacher conference? Could one of you, maybe just let's get on board with the synopsis of the play first.
Well, there is an event that has taken place.
It's Jamie Jones.
This is Jamie, hi. I play Corinne, who's the mother of Gideon, coming to see my son's fifth grade school teacher, Stace, Heather. And yeah, I've come to sort out exactly why he's been suspended for these 5 days. I don't have any information particularly, and so I show up on Monday morning to do exactly that. And from there, the fireworks begin, I suppose. I don't have any clue particularly other than that my son has come home bruised and bloodied. And he's handed me the note, of course, that he has been suspended for 5 days. So that's sort of the jumping off point, really. And I go to visit Heather, Ms. Clark, and find out what the heck went on.
How did you discover this play, Jonna Adams' work?
I think Tom Ross, who the artistic director of the Aurora, found it perhaps in an American Theater magazine a couple of years ago.
John Tracy found it.
Our director, John Tracy.
Brought it to Tom Ross.
Is that how it worked? Yeah.
Of the Aurora. They both really liked it. Evidently, there was some concern with perhaps board members. They didn't know. There are parts of the play that are very thought provoking, and so they put together a reading for the board so that they could hear it out loud. The layout of the play itself is somewhat different from other plays in that a lot of times instead of a line, a character will just have a dot, 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 which implies silence but not necessarily no communication.
An active silence.
Yeah.
So does that mean there's improvisation involved in the play then or not?
Not necessarily. I mean, we've worked out much of what those silences or those ellipses are.
But in silence, you know, we do a lot with the raise of an eyebrow or with body language, or so that it was just the playwright's way of actually writing on the page. Communication is happening here. It doesn't necessarily need language, and I haven't written language for it. So I think for the board to actually hear it instead of reading all these dots and then a line and then in four more sections of dot dot dots, ellipses, for them to actually hear it, and was very good, and I think then they were all on board for it.
So what is John Tracy, your director's approach to the play then? Is he has he been in touch with the playwright to talk about it?
Yes, yeah. John usually is. If you know, if they're alive and they answer email, they're usually pretty interactive. And I think most newer playwrights who have had email the whole time that they've been writing plays are much more apt to have direct communication with a director and say, oh, this is what I meant, or you know what, you can do whatever you want with that section, or you know, my experience with John, most playwrights seem to be very open to any questions or ideas that he has.
That's Stacey Ross playing the teacher in Jonna Adams' play Gideon's Knot at the Aurora Theater. Jamie Jones, who plays the mother, is also with me in studio. Now, do either of you have personal experience as either mothers or teachers to bring to this play?
Well, I do teach. They're adults, so I can apply some of that, I suppose. But as nor am I a mother. I am not a mother, but I'm an aunt, and I have a fifth grade nephew. Not that I exactly want to apply him to this situation, but I've seen a lot of his writing and his work and his artistry and his sketching, and I spend an awful lot of time with him. So I think, you know, I can kind of take that in and apply it to motherhood in this play.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Stacey?
I have a stepson, but we actually didn't live together until he was well into, or just beginning high school, actually. So it was never on me to go to a parent-teacher conference. I was, however, raised by a public school teacher. Mm. And remember the times of year when open house or parent-teacher conferences, and what it is for a teacher to... I spent a lot of time at my mom's school with her when I didn't want to go to my own school, and mm-hmm. time in the teacher's room with all these teachers bandying things about, you know, not work but also work, and what it is to deal with 20 to 30 different personalities and then one to two more personalities per child, depending on how many parents you're dealing with. So I do have a healthy slice of that in my background.
Mm-hmm.
I do too. We've talked about that a lot. My mother was a first grade school teacher for almost 30 years, so we've shared a lot of those kinds of stories. We did a lot of table work. We devoted the first week of rehearsal to literally sitting down with the play and sorting it out and reading it and rereading it and discussing these ellipses and what they might be, what they could be, what they should be. And it was really very helpful when we finally did get the play on its feet the second week of rehearsal, that we had really kind of pounded out a lot of, there were still many questions, but how to approach the work once it was on its feet and being staged.
Mm-hmm.
And the staging is, it's terrific. It's in a space that Nina Ball, who is John's wife, actually, she's a fantastic scenic designer. She's designed this set that is like, it's a just dead-on fifth-grade
really
schoolroom interior, and it could pass. You know, you feel like you're sitting. We hope that the audience will feel like they're sitting actually inside of that classroom with us.
I've been to a couple different fifth-grade classes to observe, and especially the most recent was very similar. Carpeting and groups of desks. They all have groups of desks now and whiteboards instead of chalkboards, and there's a more casual feel, and yet it seems to really work. Meaning, I was just stunned that kids were, you know, eating snacks before lunch. Everything was kind of, you know, dry, crunchy stuff that's easy to contain. But while they had their reading class, they were you know, snacking, and it
not like the days of your youth.
Not like the days of your at all. But you know what? They were all paying attention to what was being done. They were all really responsive when the teacher was asking questions about what they were reading. Yeah, I was really impressed. And yet there are so many similarities, too.
Mm-hmm. So what sort of issues are being raised that prompted the Washingtonian magazine to call this play heart-stopping?
It's bullying is kind of the jumping-off point, really.
Right. It sort of gets us into what isn't so much a debate, but kind of a mystery, and I think it's okay to say that
we don't want to spoil anything.
That mystery is a bit set up by the fact that there's a lot of controversy now about what defines a school's responsibility and what defines the parents' responsibility. There's a lot of gray.
Mm-hmm. Major clash in
let's
it.
Just say that they're waiting for the principal who should be there before anything is really said because the boy has been suspended. It's not a normal parent-teacher conference and it's not open house. It's a special circumstance because he has been suspended. So the principal is supposed to be there. It starts
waiting
out
time.
With waiting for the principal and how much can be said and how much can't. And this mother wants to know, and the teacher doesn't know how much she can go into it. For many reasons. I think some of them are she's considering the legalities, and I think she's considering the mother's state of mind. Right to privacy, and yeah. So it gets very thorny, and the boy is the unseen Gideon.
As is the principal unseen, right?
Is a talented writer, and you get a couple different
glimpses
of his writing.
Writing that's really beyond his years in many ways.
Which actually I saw something of in the last fifth grade class. I observed. I was reading this kid's piece about a cyclone, about a hurricane, and how he was sort of doing it in the first person. And I thought, whoa, that's a lot like Gideon. And I had thought, okay, we're calling this a 10-year-old, but she's fudged it a little bit. This is 12 or 13. And then you just do meet some 10-year-olds who just already sort of have that. But so through this writing, you get into the nature of what is art and what is censorship and how should it be used and how should it absolutely not be.
Without giving too much away.
Trying still not to give anything away.
Right, well, we'll leave it.
It is, in a sense, as John says, a sort of mystery play, and we're trying hard not
and
to
these little clues,
do any spoilers.
Yeah.
Right.
And just bit by bit throughout the course of the play, these things are slowly unraveled and revealed. And a lot of assumptions are made about these clues and on the part of myself, the mother. But deep into the play, we really get to understand a lot more.
All right. Well, we'll have to.
It is something of a mystery.
We'll have to get some people to unravel the mystery with you and experience it in person then. That's Jamie Jones playing the mother in Gideon's Knot, Jonna Adams' new play, directed by John Tracy. Stacey Ross playing the teacher. Thanks so much for coming in. We'll hope to hear from you next time around. Gideon's Knot is part of the Global Age Project, an Aurora Theater Company initiative that encourages playwrights and directors to explore life in the 21st century and beyond. Information on Gideon's Knot, now running through March 2nd, is at the Aurora Theater website, Aurora Theater, R-E Theater, that is, auroratheater.org.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
It's a pleasure to welcome my next guest back to the KALW airwaves. She tours nationally and internationally as one of America's first openly gay comics. Marga Gomez is a triple winner of the SF Bay Guardian's Best Comedian Award and was nominated for the 2006 New York Drama Desk Award for one of her shows, Los Big Names. Back where it all began, for her 10th solo show in the venue where she had her first, The Marsh presents the world premiere of Lovebirds, now through March 15th. She is in delicate voice, shall we say, but Marga, welcome. So sorry, heck of a time to catch a cold.
Oh, no, no. I don't have a cold, David. I'm 100%, 100% well.
You're preserving.
Yeah, we show people we don't get, you know, we're sick in the afternoon, and then at night we're 100% like vampires. Yeah.
Oh, dear. That kind of frightens me now to see the show at night. So Lovebirds, let's talk about the plot of Lovebirds. First of all, it's your 10th show. Congratulations. There's a lot of creativity going on in that head of yours.
There's a lot of things going on, voices, and it is my 10th solo show, and of course I love multiples of 5 and multiples of 10. The first solo show I ever did was at the Marsh in 1991, and the other cool thing is that I'm working with a director from New York, David Schweitzer, who has worked with me on Los Big Names and 4 other pieces, so it does feel like coming full circle. This show is the first show that I don't really go on stage as myself. I just play all these different characters.
Hmm. You were recently on with Marilyn Pittman, another gifted comedian for Out in the
Absolutely.
Bay.
Absolutely.
So do you consider yourself primarily a comic or an inhabitor of other people? What do you consider yourself?
I think of myself, I know this just really sounds hoity-toity, but I think of myself as a comedy performer. So I do stand up. But I love doing these solo shows. The solo shows actually got me so much recognition nationally and but the most I've ever had. It got me this big fancy agency in LA and a manager and all that. So, and they were pieces about my family. My parents were pretty interesting characters. They were in Spanish show business. So, this piece is in the, you know, it's kind of biographical, but it's not me necessarily, but aspects of myself and people that I have met. I think I went off topic.
No, well, no, let's back up. Let's put you back on the analyst's couch for a minute.
Oh, am I a comedian or so? So I'm both. I'm a Gemini.
You're a performer.
Yes, I'm a performer.
Let's back up and get you back on the couch and ask you a little bit about your growing up back in New York as a Puerto Rican Cuban American. Were you a mimic as a kid as well when you were growing up in New York?
No, my dad was a comedian, and so my mom was a dancer, but I dance badly. I belong to the minority of Latinos who can't dance. We're oppressed by the majority of Latinos who can.
And you hate tacos, too, or something.
Well, Puerto Ricans and Cubans don't have tacos, but it's okay. it's okay, David. We'll work together.
We'll work on that.
So I really loved what my father did, and again, you know, in this business, it is, you know, it's art, but it's also a business. You have to be versatile. And comedy, people associate it with stand-up and this very efficient one-liner, but that's really a shame because comedy is such a large medium and there's so many ways to deliver it. And in solo performance, I've always used it, even in difficult subjects, to resolve issues. So, this piece is definitely one of the lightest pieces I've ever done.
Well, give us a storyline of Lovebirds, if you would. If there's a through line, I don't know, is there?
Well, it's kind of a tapestry, and it's sort of, they've been saying, wow, I didn't know where it was going, and they were scared, but then it was, you know, very... It all made sense in a very sort of abstract way. It's a little abstract. It's stories of lovers, ex-lovers, would-be lovers, following their passion, their incurable romantics, and they weave through the 70s to 2014, and a lot of the lives intersect. So it's really just about 5 different stories happening in this one show.
And how many characters are involved then?
I think there's about 6.
Okay.
Yeah, 6. Mm-hmm. There's Turkey, the old school butch in the lesbian bar. There's Dahlia, who's the woman studies major who changes her mind and her name and her hair every week with a different book she reads. There's Dahlia's father, Orestes, who is a macho maitre d', and he is in love with a married woman. This woman is married to a professor who never sleeps, and so he it falls into this dream, this 70s disco dream. Yeah, and that's just, you know, just for you, the normal ones.
That's great. Now, are these based on real people or just kind of sketches that you've had in your own head?
You know, they actually are. They are based on unreal people that I have met. You know, when I came out in the 70s at this lesbian bar in Manhattan, and my father actually worked across town in Greenwich Village in a Spanish restaurant. I mean, nothing could be straighter and nothing could be gayer than where each of us was. And there used to be a lady who took Polaroid pictures. That's actually the narrator of the show, Polaroid Philly. Mm-hmm. And she would go from the gay bar to my father's restaurant. So I would go to my father's restaurant to get some free paella, and there would be the photographer from the gay bar, and I was always like, you know, just, oh, she knows, and she's going to tell. So she has become the narrator of the story, and she has contact with all the characters.
Hmm. Now, as you inhabit these characters, are you anxious to make people laugh, or you just make anxious to have them inhabit the character with you?
Oh, yeah. Some audiences laugh a lot, and some audiences... one woman at the end of the show said she'd never seen me before. She really liked the show, but she didn't laugh because she was processing it all. It's like, and she wasn't a lesbian. This is heterosexual processing. That really is intense.
That's heavy duty.
Yeah. So I think it's a mistake for any theater performer to try to make the audience laugh. You have to just honor the content. And so that's what I do when I honor these characters. You know, they're all affectionate characters.
In that respect, does the show evolve throughout the run, or do you find it difficult to keep to the exact script that you've developed? Does it change at all?
My director, David Schweitzer, is quite
ruler in hand,
clear
slapping
about,
the knuckles.
You know, I mean, I wrote it, so, you know, so it's not a bad thing. Sometimes we were doing the show, and he'd say, that's not what's in the script. And then I'd see what's in the script, and it's like, oh, yeah, that's really good. I wrote that. So, we workshopped it at the Marsh in 2013 for about 4 weeks. And so the show got, you know, to a certain level. And then just before we had the official opening at the Marsh 2 weeks ago, we had a 4-day breakneck tech period, rewriting period, and the script, as they say, is frozen. But the performances continue to evolve.
Right.
But the lines are, they're good.
You did an Indiegogo campaign for Lovebirds.
Yes,
can you share a little bit why you went with Indiegogo and what that whole experience was like?
Well, I actually was going to start with, first of all, apparently it's expensive to put on a show because I have a team of wonderful designers, a great sound designer and director coming in from New York. So I needed, you know, like some G's. Is that what the kids call it? So I tried to do Kickstarter, and I'd always seen the Kickstarter things, but it was, I didn't just seem really complicated, and it seemed like it was slow to start it, and I was already like 2 weeks before the show opened. So Indiegogo seemed a lot faster to do, and it was really fun. I don't know, Kickstarter, there's something very formal or business-like about it, and Indiegogo is kind of just like cute and like a silly puppy. That's I don't know.
I heard something.
Everything's a puppy.
I heard
me.
Something about a call for shoeboxes. Does that have to do with the
yes.
set? Integral to the set.
This was really, yeah. You know, my dad, he was also a comedian, but he was also a producer. So I have that obsessive need to be hands-on for everything. We decided that this shoebox design, this abstract shoebox design, would be great for the set because Polaroid Philly has, like, keeps all the Polaroids. So, and we painted them silver because this is sort of the disco era. So it looks awesome, but we needed a lot of shoeboxes, and apparently they're hard to get. So I would go to Nordstrom's. I would go to, everything in my neighborhood, and I would get, and some people were very nice about it, and some people were, no, we just crush them. It's like, well, why can't I just have them? No. So someday I'm going to just go back to those good shoe stores and buy some shoes. I collected 60 shoe boxes. I take them on the Muni. I tried to take them on the Google bus, but I didn't have a laminate. So,
now, how has your approach to solo performances changed? Now, this is your 10th show. You mentioned a couple of the lesbian characters that are in this show. Do all of the shows have some sort of a romantic element or some sort of a gay theme or subtext to them?
Well, because the shows, you know, have been autobiographical. Then, of course, there's a gay element, but some shows have been, you know, it's just like Los Big Names, you know, it's about me and my parents. So it's as heterosexual as it is gay, but I play all the parts. So, you know, maybe I do inform the heterosexual characters. But this piece, Lovebirds, is, it's about love. It just pure love, and I would hope that people, you know, walk away with seeing that all the characters were ridiculous in their pursuits, and that love is, you know, it's a double-edged sword. So I really, when I look at the script, it seems to be very divided evenly in the world of the sexist macho maitre d' who's going to, you know, listen, you know, who needs to listen to his more evolved side, and he learns that lesson, and this professor who's very chauvinist, to this world that's forgotten in the old lesbian clubs. You know, lesbians are very invisible, and that was really one of the one of the things that made me happy about doing the show is, you know, is I got to revive that location in New York that was so important to so many people, and, you know, but not remembered or documented.
Hmm. So this is your 10 shows in now. What's the writing process like for you? Does it come easily to you? Are you a tortured artist in terms of what comes out? Or are you just like flowing like the
Oh, river? It's horrible, David.
Yeah,
that's why I'm single. I just want to like keep thinking, like want to keep, you know, keep polishing. So that's why it's so nice the script is like set. But it happens. I can't write like in a reasonable I procrastinate is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And so like when I did the previews, you know, it was kind of up to the minute that I was on. Fortunately, I can learn text very quickly, so I don't have a problem with that. But it's unless I have that pressure, I can't seem to motivate myself to write. But
is that the case with your other shows as well?
Always. I mean, and that's why The Marsh has this wonderful Monday Night Marsh where you can go and you bring a 15-minute segment. And so that, you know, I have always been somebody who books the show, and then I figure it out. I come up with a title, I book it, and it's from the every show. Every show has been like that. But working with David's great because he kind of knows, and he keeps me on track. And, you know, we had the preview period, the workshop period, so that also helps. But I don't know. I don't know what I really want to say until just before the audience shows up on that opening night.
much to David's chagrin.
Yes, he's a very patient man.
You've done a lot of work outside of the club circuit and outside of solo shows. You were in a production, a few productions of the Vagina Monologues. Film and television credits include HBO's Tracy Takes On, Sphere, even Batman Forever. So what else is on your plate apart from the solo show run after this?
Well, actually, what I'm going to do is a little different. I'm going to start teaching performance, and I've just got been asked. This is the first time I'm saying it. Actually, it just happened yesterday. But Brava Theater is going to have me be an artist in residence, so I'm going to be mentoring and teaching comedy performance.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
Yeah, so I'm excited. I wanted to do that. I have had like one-on-one coaching sessions, and traveling around the country and in universities, I have met with students and have done some of that. And it's really a rush. It's, you know, and I didn't know that I was good at it, but I am.
That takes some special skills. You're very fortunate for that. That's great.
And besides that, Lovebirds is going to go to New York in June.
Fantastic.
At the La Mama Theater.
Nice.
So,
nice.
Yeah. Yeah, that all. This has been a really great week, except for this little, you know, real cold.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, I'll let you stop talking. Thanks for taking some time today.
My pleasure, David.
A terrific review from Robert Hurwit in The Chronicle. Congrats. That
Thank
can't
you.
Hurt.
Good one in The Examiner as well.
Oh, nice. All right. Marga Gomez, Lovebirds, directed by David Schweitzer, is at The Marsh now through the 15th of March. You can find information at The Marsh's website, themarsh.org, or at margagomez.com. Thanks again, Marga.
Thank you, David. A pleasure.
This week, the San Francisco Symphony features two French artists. Conductor Lionel Bronguier makes his San Francisco debut, while pianist Hélène Grimaud returns to play Brahms' Piano Concerto No. 1. Also on the program, Dutilleux's Métabole and Ravel's La Valse, a wonderful program. One of the performances was last night. Another happens today, 2 o'clock, just right after open air, with a final performance on Friday evening. So I spoke with pianist Hélène Grimaud earlier in the week in the green room at Davies Symphony Hall. And here is that talk. Hélène, welcome back to San Francisco.
Thank you very much.
You are a fascinating person, both musically and extra-musically. I'm wondering if you could tell me what it is about Johannes Brahms specifically that's drawn you again and again to this repertoire.
You know, it's difficult to say, but clearly Johannes Brahms is one of the most significant composers for the piano, so he has to be, you know, part of any musician's, any pianist's life in any case. I fell in love with his music early on, and this is something which there is no foreseeable end to, because also of the depth of the repertoire, there is something which forces you to keep at it, keep playing it, revisiting it. So, and now, of course, is a particularly intense phase because of having just recorded both the first concerto and the second concerto, and the recording having just come out in the fall. Necessarily, I'm playing, you know, a lot of these two pieces this season. That's a beautiful thing because I love being in the company of his music. There is something so incredibly poignant about the quality of expression in Brahms, and what I love is that, you know, you feel this. He's in direct lineage, going from Johann Sebastian Bach, Ludwig van Beethoven, and then you have Johannes Brahms. And there is a beautiful synthesis of classicism and romanticism in his writing, in his language. So all very good reasons to be spending a lot of time with him.
These are very unusual concerti in that they're very interwoven with the orchestra. Instead of just being a virtuoso flourish here or there, it's very much integrated into the orchestra, which had a lot of controversy when they first came out as well.
Yes, you're absolutely right. But I think that this is one of the most beautiful aspects of these two pieces, and particularly in the first one, where you might as well say that it is a symphony with piano obbligato. And, you know, and especially playing with an orchestra like the San Francisco Symphony, with whom I've been making music now for, you know, 2.5 decades, it's an added pleasure, because if you play with people that you respect and love, in a piece like this, there has to be this osmosis. Otherwise, I think you're not respecting the spirit in which the piece was written. And so this is something that I'm particularly looking forward to this week. Mm-hmm.
I should mention that prior to the Brahms release on Deutsche Grammophon, your prior album was called Duo, a collaboration with cellist Sol Gabetta, which won the 2013 Echo Award for Chamber Recording of the Year and was nominated for a 2014 Grammy Award. Congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you very much. It's, of course, a very nice thing. We always appreciate recognition from people from the industry and colleagues especially. It's something that you hear about with gratitude.
And your first nomination, I mean, you've up to 20 CDs now. You've been recording since you were 15 years old.
That's true. It's been a big part of my life. I've loved recording, actually, since that very first experience for Denon Nippon Columbia, when I recorded this Rachmaninoff program with the second piano sonata and the Etude Table Opus 33. You know, it's funny because sometimes you hear about how recording is, you know, more sterile, and that there isn't the level of emotional excitement that you find in the live. And even though I do love recording live as well and do it as often as I possibly can, at the same time, I always found that there is a very special quality of, indeed, of emotion and concentration in a recording. You know, when the red light comes on, you feel as if this presence comes down onto the space, this sort of whoo. And I've always found it to be, on the contrary, a very fertile environment for music making. So I've loved the process, love everything about it.
Including the editing process and selecting the best takes?
Absolutely. I find that totally fascinating. I mean, now, mind you, I don't really like repeating things very much, and I find that I tend to revert to the first take anyway,
very often. That said, it's also an interesting way of exploring different options. So instead of repeating something, just to do it over and over again, which doesn't really bring anything, you just lose physical freshness, you lose spontaneity in the music making. So sometimes actually you take, you know, the piece in different directions. But it's it is very interesting to see how, and often I discuss it with colleagues and I see it's the same with them. They tend to go back to those first takes, which have the most sort of urgency.
Freshness to them.
Yeah.
You are a synesthete. I'm wondering if you could help explain to our listening audience what exactly that means for people that don't know.
Well, it means there are many different manifestations of synesthesia, but apparently this this one is about seeing colors when you hear sounds, and it's not quite as rare as people might imagine. I mean, apparently many people have associations between, for example, I don't know, even simple things like numbers or letters of the alphabet with different colors. But this is something which manifested itself when I first was, I think, about 11 years old. I was practicing practicing a Bach prelude in F sharp major, and I started seeing this stain, very vivid, sort of red, bright orange stain with undefined contours in front of me. And I was quite charmed by the phenomenon, didn't ask myself many questions at that time, of course, at that age, just took it in stride. And
So this is not closing your eyes, actually seeing the color with your eyes open.
Yes, exactly. It is not systematic. It's not every time I listen to music or make music, but it's quite often, and it's related to the tonality. So, you know, maybe going back to this idea of the Baroque era, where every tonality has its own emotional identity. For me, it's very, very strongly connected to this. So, of course, I mean, with every modulation, the color will change, but the dominant color is that of the tonality in which the piece was written.
And so what color is D minor, the Brahms first concerto for you?
It's dark blue. So,
but it changes throughout the piece?
Yes, it does. With every modulation, it does.
So. Is that more vivid when you do close your eyes as opposed to concentrating on just the music and the atmosphere in front of you?
Yes, absolutely. If I close my eyes, it's more the concrete color. If I if my eyes are still open, it's more the idea of the color. So I know that the color is there, but of course it's not quite the same sensorial experience as when I can make abstraction of what surrounds me. So it does take on, you know, slightly different incarnations, but you know, I like to refer to it as a byproduct of an altered sense of perception, meaning that it's not something which, I mean, you're not missing anything if you don't have that. It's not, I don't think, bringing much, you know, added value to the experience of listening to music. I think that when you're exposed to an art form as powerful as music is, some of your other you know, senses are just somehow stimulated and sharpened.
So is your technique affected by the colors that you're seeing then as you modulate, or is it all dictated by the notes that are there?
No, there is absolutely no effect whatsoever. So this is just something that manifests itself, but it doesn't really cause any, it doesn't change anything. It's not going to affect what I'm doing. It's just, an extra sort of layer of...
Awareness.
Of awareness, exactly, very good word.
So you said it doesn't affect you all the time. It's not like if you go by a cafe and there's some music playing, you see some orange or you see some yellow coming out of a car.
No, it can happen, but no, that's pretty rare. Again, it seems to be pretty random. But and I saw a documentary on the BBC about this, very, very interesting, and it takes on so many, it has so many different forms. I mean, there are people for whom smells will trigger, colors or just all sorts of different associations.
The brain is a mysterious thing. I'd like to applaud you for your work as co-founder of the Wolf Conservation Center in Upper New York State. I read that your love for the endangered species was sparked by a chance encounter with a wolf in northern Florida. Could you tell us about that? It must have been a memorable experience.
It was, but she wasn't a pure wolf. She was a high-content wolf hybrid, still, nevertheless, different enough from any domestic canine I'd ever met to be, you know, clearly interesting to the point of being actually the very reason why the Wolf Conservation Center exists today. So, you know, the idea being that, you know, through an encounter with such an animal, it builds a bridge of understanding and concern for their wild counterparts. And so this is one of the reasons why the Wolf Center has ambassador animals. We have this fantastic traveling ambassador wolf who goes to so many different places, universities, and has gone down to Washington. I mean, you name it. He's been all over the place and has reached thousands and thousands of people. And, you know, there is no long-term hope for conservation without education. That's where it begins, because the main obstacle to these animals' recovery is human tolerance or the lack thereof, actually. So that remains one of the main aspects of the mission. But parallel to that, we're also involved with the SSP program, the Species Survival Plan, and we are also a captive holding and breeding facility for some of the most endangered wolf species and subspecies. Species in the case of the red wolf, subspecies in the case of the Mexican wolf. And in preparation for their reintroduction into, you know, federally designated areas, parts of their original range. So it's very exciting work.
And so this, the center that you've established as its own way of operating, do you find a difficult balance to find time between your music and what you want to do? You want to spend more time with the Wolf Center?
Well, yes, that's a good question. I mean, of course, now the Wolf Center has grown to the point of running itself quite competently. I mean, we have a wonderful team of volunteers and staff and a great board as well, which is a great source of, you know, sort of peace of mind for me, because I know that the right people are there to take the organization into the future no matter what. But I, of course, enjoy being close to the project. There is, of course, also more I can do by being there. So it's always, you know, it's always a difficult balance. There are always so many things that you could be doing with your time. Music tends to be an all-consuming affair, really. And so you always have to be careful to keep some, you know, pockets of time, if only to also enrich your music making. I mean, as an artist, you can't live in a vacuum. So this is something which you always have to think about.
Pianist, nature conservationist, human rights activist, writer. You've got a latest semi-autobiographical novel coming out called Retour à Salem. What else is on your plate in terms of projects, or is that enough for you?
Well, for now, I would say it's enough, although there's always more that can be done in all of these different fields. Again, it's a matter of time management. I'm blessed to have been, you know, given a lot of energy, so I'm able to do quite a lot with the hours available in one day. And, you know, it has to be said also that sometimes, as schizophrenic as this mode of life is, you know, with the traveling, it also maybe helps you to be, you know, 200% focused on something for a phase, and then do something else in between or actually parallel. So I think it's, you know, sometimes people imagine that this is a pretty, you know, incompatible thing to be trying and lead side by side, but it's really not the case if you think about the German Romantics and the fact that, you know, one of the main precepts of that movement was that nature is the ultimate muse. And in fact, if you see, you know, how many composers, poets, writers seem to need to recharge batteries and take their, you know, sort of root in this sort of global intuition, it's something which makes a lot of sense.
And you find inspiration from that.
Indeed.
The Brahms First Concerto was famously hissed at its second performance in Leipzig in 1859. Have you ever encountered audiences behaving badly due to your unique interpretation of some classic works?
Well, not yet, at least not in that fashion. But that's the nice thing about these stories, is that you realize if something like this were to happen, or of course the very simple fact that not everyone likes what an artist does, and actually it would be sort of suspect if that were the case, right? Because then it wouldn't be art anymore.
It would be living.
Yes, indeed. That's exactly right. So that is something always somehow amusing to realize, is that you are in very good company when it comes to you know, certain more individualistic aspects of your approach. It's totally normal that it should not be everyone's cup of tea. And again, the contrary would be worrisome. Then you'd have to ask yourself if the playing is sort of authentic enough, in fact.
Well, maybe instead of hisses of disapproval, we can hear some wolf howls of approval at these concerts.
I don't think either are necessary, really, frankly speaking. I think that, you know, hopefully when people come to a concert, they experience emotion and exhilaration to various degrees, everyone through their subjective, you know, filter and what they've been through sometimes that day. Sometimes that's enough to change how you hear music. And all you can do is be absolutely yourself out there, give 200% of what you have, and you know, let the music do the rest, because at the end we're just interpreters.
Hélène, enchanté de faire votre connaissance, and I wish you well for these performances and all of your endeavors.
Thank you very much. All the best for you.
This is cool.
Oh, good. Cool indeed. Hélène Grimaud is the soloist for Brahms Piano Concerto No. 1 in about 15 minutes at 2 p.m. at Davies Hall, also tomorrow night. Performance information at sfsymphony.org. Let's hear a track from her Grammy-nominated recording on Deutsche Grammophon, Duo, with Saul Gabetta on cello. This is Hélène Grimaud performing an excerpt from Shostakovich's Sonata for Cello and Piano in D minor. Sonata for Violin, Cello, and Piano in D minor, Shostakovich, music performed by Hélène Grimaud on piano and Saul Gabetta on cello, from the Grammy-nominated recording Duo on Deutsche Grammophon. Good afternoon, David LaTulipe with Open Air on KALW, welcoming Joshua Cosman back for the first Thursday of the month. Joshua, this seems to be our Binders of Women episode of Open Air. What's in your binder? Do we continue that theme along today?
You're counting me as one of the women? Or? No, all right. Well, yeah, we do have a lot of women, but some men too, just okay. To keep things interesting. One of the things that's happening this month that I'm really looking forward to is a first-time collaboration between the string players of the orchestra of the New Century Chamber Orchestra, which is led by violinist Nadia Salerno Sonnenberg, in partnership with the singers of the San Francisco Opera Center, the Adler Fellows, who are connected with the San Francisco Opera. And they're going to be doing a performance this month of Rita, which is a one-act comic opera by Donizetti.
Completely off my radar.
Yeah, rarely done, like many of the sort of minor Donizetti pieces. And yet, we were just talking before we went on the air, I have seen a production of this. I can't remember where or when, but the plot is unforgettable because it's a lighthearted romp about domestic abuse. And it's about a woman, Rita, the title character, who has the bad habit of beating her husband and how he gets out of it with the collaboration of another fellow who is willing to take Rita off his hands, but instead teaches her to how to live with a husband without beating him with a stick.
Okay.
So, you know, useful life lessons for everyone, all done in comic Italian.
Well, let's hear a little excerpt,
sure.
About it, shall we? What are we going to hear from this particular aria?
This is a recording that I found on my shelf.
I was going to say that's even more unique that you actually had this on your shelf.
I have no idea what it was doing there, but it's an old recording from the 1990s, recorded in 1991, and it's got Adelina Scarabelli in the title role, and Alessandro Corbelli, who's been here a number of times, as the baritone Gasparo. This is the Orchestra di Camera Siciliana, conducted by Federico Amendola.
And an excerpt of Donizetti, and then more with Joshua Cosman.
E la conservo molto gelosamente. Cara gioia, gloria mia, torno a te ripien, ripien d'ardo.
Excerpt from Donizetti's Rita.
Not about a meter maid, but about the brighter side of domestic abuse. And that's going to be in a production with three of the Adler Fellows who are at the Samsco Opera, soprano Maria Valdez in the title role, tenor Thomas Glenn, a former Adler Fellow, actually, and baritone Ephraim Solis. Also on the program are some operatic works for orchestra by Verdi, Massenet, and Mascagni.
That sounds like a great collaboration.
Yeah.
NCCO.org. This is
right.
The New Century Chamber Orchestra
That's
website.
February 11th through the 16th at various locations around the Bay, as they do. Stepping now from the 19th century to the 21st, we have a solo recital by the percussionist Stephen Schick, which is a landmark event for local folks because this is the first time that he's given a solo performance here in about 30 years. And Stephen Schick is well known to the new music folks primarily as a percussionist and also a conductor. And in the last couple of years has taken the helm of the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players to great effect. I think it's been an absolutely key addition to their repertoire there to have him on hand. But he is an absolutely virtuosic performer on various kinds of percussion instruments. And he is going to be giving a solo performance of with pieces by Stockhausen, Morton Feldman, Helmut Lachenmann, James Tenney and Xenakis, of course, the Greek-French composer who did more than anything to put solo percussion pieces on the map. That's February 14th, if you're feeling romantic. there's nothing more romantic than to sit with your beloved and listen to percussion music, in my humble view. That'll be at the San Francisco JCC.
JCCSF.org for information on that fascinating concert.
Yep. Even more up to date, we have this very evening, I guess I'll be in Berkeley, and I think you will too.
I will.
For the Berkeley Symphony, Juana Carnaro is going to lead the world premiere of a new violin concerto by Samuel Carl Adams, the son of John Adams. And he's got a new piece that he's written for the orchestra, about which we know very little. Anthony Marwood, a terrific new music violinist, is going to be the soloist. But Samuel Carl Adams is someone whose work has suddenly become more commonly heard around here. Michael Tilson Thomas in the San Francisco Symphony did his piece, Drift in Providence.
Indeed, we talked about that on the air last time he was in town.
Oh, you had him on the show?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Okay, he talks a good game, I know.
Yeah,
and writes
good
a
guy.
He writes a good piece. So I'm looking forward to that. That'll be tonight in Zellerbach Hall in Berkeley.
We happen to be a media sponsor for that event. We'll be broadcasting that concert in May. We're recording it for broadcast in May. Also on the program, Stravinsky's Pulcinella Suite and the Scottish Symphony of Felix Mendelssohn. And our good friend Paul Drescher will be doing the pre-concert talk at 7. So there you go.
Everything's connected.
Fine night in Berkeley.
Yes.
If damp.
And then tomorrow night, Friday night, the 7th, I'm going to go back to Berkeley for a performance by the Venice Baroque Orchestra. This is a terrific period instrument band from Italy that is coming with the French countertenor Philippe Jaruski. He's been here before, and I've never heard him live. I had some scheduling conflict, so I only know him from his recordings, which are very fine indeed. And let's listen to a little bit of it, and then I'll talk a little bit about this program. This is an aria that he will be doing tomorrow night by Nicola Porpora from the opera Arianna e Teseo, which is Ariadne and Theseus, Mio in Cielo.
Voice of Philippe Jaruski in performance on a CD from Erato. He will be in performance with the Venice Baroque Orchestra in a program of works of Porpora and Handel. Where is that again, Josh?
That's at First Congregational Church in Berkeley, presented by Cal Performances. The information is at calperformances.org. And that program is actually going to be a bit of a musical a feud. You know, Handel in 18th century London. 18th century London was a hotbed of musical feuds of various kind. Handel feuded with several of his competitors in the music business, and Porpora was one of them. Porpora had his pet castrato, which was Farinelli. Handel had a castrato who sang his music, and several of them, but one of them was Carestini. And this program is going to show us both sides of that feud, and we'll see who wins. I have my bet in.
Well, without the actual Farinelli on Porpora's side, I don't know.
That may be that may be skewing the game a little bit.
What else you got?
Well, some very interesting guest conductors are coming into Davies Hall this month to appear with the San Francisco Symphony before Michael Tilson Thomas returns at the end of the month. Next week, we have a Dutch program. Jaap van Zweden, the great Dutch conductor, who is the new music director of, not so new anymore, he's been a few years, the music director of the Dallas Symphony, will finally be making his San Francisco Symphony debut. It was supposed to happen a couple of years ago, and then something came up, and he had to cancel at the last minute. But he will be in town on February 12th through 14th. Simone Lamsma, the Dutch violinist, will also be making her debut, playing the Sibelius Violin Concerto, and van Zweden will be conducting music of Mozart and Tchaikovsky. So that will be the first time we get to hear what he can do.
All those concert information details at sfsymphony.org.
Correct. And the following week, from February 19th to 22nd, the Spanish conductor Rafael Frubeck de Burgos comes back to the symphony for the first time since 1985. So that certainly predates my weekly attendance at symphony concerts, so I'm looking forward to that. He's got a program of Haydn, a cello concerto with Elisa Weilerstein, I don't know, she's American, as soloist, and a Rimsky-Korsakov Scheherazade. And that'll be February 19th through the 22nd.
Great. And finally, music from other minds. I'm sure we'll have some guests on from them.
I should hope so, yeah. I just want to make sure that I get a plug-in for the Other Minds Festival, because that's on February 28th and March 1st. Charles Amarkanian has his usual great lineup of interesting conductors, composers, rather, and performers, including Mark Applebaum, jazz great Roscoe Mitchell, Donald Buchla, and some others who are too numerous to mention with time running out. So thank you very much.
Sure, always an amazing festival, Music from Other Minds. We broadcast Music from Other Minds every Friday evening at 11 here on KLW.
And rightly so.
And just I want to conclude with a couple of picks from the podium, so to speak, of the announcer's desk here. I've toot my own flute or horn, so to speak. Next Tuesday, I'll be guest soloist with the Golden Gate Philharmonic Youth Orchestra. I'll be performing with them Arthur Foote's Nocturne and Scherzo. Also, there's a benefit for Noe Valley Chamber Music at featuring Robin Sutherland. Information about that benefit at nvcm.org. It starts with a live auction and a silent auction, a very worthwhile cause, Noe Valley Chamber Music. And if you like wind music, the place to be on this Saturday, February 8th, is at Knuth Hall at San Francisco State University. You'll hear the San Francisco Wind Ensemble. My recent guest, music director Martin Segalka, will be having performing works by Gutkowski, Prokofiev, and Karel Husa's magnificent Music for Prague, 1968. I'm David LaTulipe. It's open air for the... What day is today? The 6th of February. Details, you can hear this show and get more details about open air at our website, kalw.org. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for helping it all happen.